Today I wanted to employ a simile which I just mentioned in passing last night. And I'm using this simile in order to explain just how the meditation works and how you never go on to a next stage of meditation. You only go into the next stage of meditation. You stay where you are, peaceful, still, as much as you can, and these stages develop by themselves. But it was also I wanted to start talking about some of the other stages which happen after present moment awareness and silence and you're watching the breath. What happens next? Because there's much more to meditation than just sitting watching your breath. And that particular simile also explains that little mantra which I said last night, which somebody asked me to say very slowly, the Om Mani Padme Hum mantra. And for those of you who don't know what that actually means, it's the first and the last word, the Om and the Hum. They're just little syllables, which are syllables of respect. Just like in Pali, like Namo. It just means like respect, worship. So it means, you know, worship, and the two words in between are the important ones. That's Mani Padme. It's exactly the same as in Pali. This is Sanskrit. And it means the jewel in the lotus. So it really means we worship the jewel in the heart of the lotus. And now I would explain what that means with a simile which will show you how to meditate and what's going to happen and how fun, fantastic it's going to be for you. Because this lotus is a symbol of Buddhism. And you see even here, you've got lotus flowers next to the Buddha, you've got a lotus in that wooden thing. And lotuses or loti, is it lotuses or loti? Or lotus eye? I don't know. Someone can correct me on that one. But the lotuses, I think it is. The lotuses are a symbol of Buddhism. And I mentioned one of the symbolisms which was used. That if you pour any disgusting stuff on a lotus or any fragrant stuff, if it's Chanel number 5 or the urine in your toilet after a day of not flushing it, still it just falls off it and it leaves no residue. In other words, it's a symbol of letting go. So whatever falls on the lotus, nothing remains. That's a very beautiful way of looking at your mind and your body as well. So whatever comes to your mind, whatever beautiful moment or whether difficult moment, you keep nothing. So the past leaves no residue. That's a very beautiful way of letting go. Imagining your mind like this beautiful lotus. You've had so many experiences in your life, so many experiences so far in this retreat, so many experiences even this morning. But every experience, it just drops off you like a bead of water off a lotus leaf, leaving no residue. And then you always have the pure mind like a fragrant lotus. So don't let anything linger. When somebody asked last night, what do you do when people are rude to you, cruel to you, abuse you, say rotten things about you? Just remember, you're a lotus. It just rolls off you with no remainder. So that's one of the most beautiful similes, ways of using the lotus. But the simile I wanted to talk about is specifically meditation, and it is a simile of the 1,000-petal lotus. Now, reminded myself of this when we talked about that TV show which I did, and this is the essence of that little sermon on TV, was explaining the simile of a 1,000-petal lotus. And it gave me the opportunity to describe the different stages of meditation all the way into the jhanas. But it also gave me the opportunity of describing just how the whole process happens without any effort from you. And what is really important is not effort, but mindfulness and care, compassion. Because a lotus, like, you see the lotus which is all closed up. Now, if you do go and see a lotus pond, maybe still this time in the morning, maybe it's starting to open up now, but at night time the lotus closes up its petals. And so it's just a hard bud. And when the sun comes up, the light and the warmth of the sun starts to open out the petals, one by one. The outer layer of petals receives the warmth and the light and opens up. And that allows the warmth and light to strike the next layer of petals so they can open up. So that the next layer of petals, now that can receive the light and warmth, and it opens up. As one opens up, it gives the opportunity for the layer inside of it to receive the warmth and the light, so it too can open up. So the lotus opens up one layer after another in sequence whenever it can receive the warmth and the light. And that's how you open up the lotus. Now, in this simile, the warmth and the light refer to compassion, warmth, mindfulness, light. You shine your kindness and your mindfulness on whatever you're looking at. And if that mindfulness and that kindness is maintained, the lotus opens up. Now, first of all, the first part of that lotus, the outermost leaf, that has to withstand all the wind and the dust, because that is the outermost shell. And so that outermost petal of the lotus is always the roughest, the coarsest, the dirtiest, with hardly any fragrance at all. If it has got any fragrance, it probably hasn't. It's the most unlikely thing to contain a beautiful flower. But inside that rough, coarse, unpromising outermost petal of the lotus, as we all know, lies his incredibly fragrant, delicate lotus petals. And the first part of the simile is just like you in this hopeless case, this person who hasn't been able to meditate for years, this person who's crazy and always thinking or falling asleep and say, how can anything beautiful be inside of me? Ah, but it is. You just need to open yourself out and see, yes, inside you, you've got this incredible, fragrant, beautiful, delightful jhanas, enlightenment, the whole works. Yes, you can do it. That's the first little teaching. In every lotus, even on the outside, it may look hard and dirty. Inside is pure and fragrant. So you have that possibility. It's inside of you. You just have to learn how to open up those outermost petals. So what you do is just be kind. Be mindful. Let the sun of, rather the light of mindfulness and the warmth of compassion just stay. So that's what you do. Sit down, this old body, aching, old, whatever, dirty because you haven't showered for a couple of days. Sit down here, uncomfortable. What do you do? You're just caring and aware. Nothing more. If you try and peel that lotus, you'll destroy all the petals. You just wait. Kindness and mindfulness with whatever you're watching, and it starts to open out. And when you get to the first layer of petals, that's called present moment awareness. You're going in. Because the present moment, as I've mentioned many times, is right in the center of this thing we call time. In the middle of your life. Right in this moment. In this moment. That's what we call a present moment. I've often wondered about time. Why is it we keep wandering off into the past or the future? What actually creates time? As far as I'm concerned, even though I was a physicist before, I'm more like the metaphysics, that is craving which creates time. And when we have no craving, when we let it go for a few minutes, time vanishes. Because what is time anyway? It's just a measurement between the present and the future. or the past and the present, or the past and the future. When that past and future disappears, there's no place to measure anymore. You're just in this moment, and time vanishes for you. And it's such a beautiful freedom to be free of this prison we call time. Now you measure your years, how old you are, how many more years you've got left. You measure your day into how many things you can fit into the 24 hours. And we always have these clocks which we have to look at. And they sort of control us. Yeah, you might be enjoying yourself, but no, you've got to be somewhere else. The clock tells you so. So the clock is the torturer. No, time is the person who keeps you in jail, stops you being free. And just so imagine just going right into the center of time where time no longer exists. You feel so incredibly free and peaceful and happy. And so even that first layer of petals of the lotus is very, very beautiful and is well worth the patience to be able to allow that lotus to open up. But on the subject of patience, sometimes people say, yeah, they are patient, they've been waiting and nothing happens. And I realize that they're practicing the wrong type of patience. There are two types of patience. The first one, the wrong one, I call waiting in the future. You're waiting for something to happen. You're not in the moment. You're just a few moments ahead of yourself, looking down the road to see what's coming, rather than seeing what's already here. It's called waiting in the future. And if you're waiting in the future, that's where you're sitting in. Nothing's happening, nothing's happening. When's it going to happen? I want the light, I want the jhanas, I want this, I want that. And that's not waiting at all. That's not being patient. That's waiting for something to happen. Waiting in the future. You've lost the present moment. The other type of waiting is like the waiter at a restaurant. You wait on the moment. Just like you wait on the people at the table. You're aware, watching, so that when the plate is empty, you can go and take it away and deliver their next course. You're in the moment, alert, aware, waiting on the moment, rather than waiting in the future. If you understand that, you understand why a lot of people make mistakes in meditation. They think they're sort of doing nothing, but then they are doing something, they're waiting for the future. Waiting for something to happen, which makes you very frustrated, because it never happens. So, we wait in the moment. And so when we're in that present moment, we're just here with what's happening, waiting in this moment, or rather waiting on this moment, and then we are mindful, and we're also caring for this moment. As I mentioned earlier on, a mother who cares for her baby will never drop it in the shopping center. A person who's got a winning lottery ticket will be holding on to it, looking at it every moment as they go to try and claim their winnings. If it's something valuable to you, you'll always be caring for it. So by caring for this moment, whatever it is, that care and that present moment awareness, that just waiting in this moment, that will actually allow, that mindfulness and that care, that will allow this present moment to actually open up for you. There's a huge amount happening right now, but at first when we see it, it's sort of closed. But as we stay there, it opens up and there's so much going on right now. More than enough to interest and satisfy anybody. Which is why we just have to have that patience, waiting in this moment, and then it opens up. We see all the incredible, wonderful things which are happening right now. This is your life happening right now. It's important. Soon you'll all be dead. You can't afford to waste this moment. And those of you who think I'm bored, just remember this time next week, you'll be back at work. Oh my God. You'll be back with your husband, back with your wife, back with your screaming kids, back in the traffic going to work. So please enjoy every moment, because it won't last. So we stay in this moment, valuing it, caring for it. So with that mindfulness and caring on this present moment, we don't do anything. That's all that we have to generate, mindfulness and care. And then, just like the lotus being warmed by the sun, by its heat and by its light, it opens out. In other words, you just go into the next layer of petals, which lies right in the center of present moment awareness, and that is the silent mind. Right in the center of now, N-O-W is O, nothing, zero. And right in the center of O is this big space, circumscribed by a circle. There's nothing in there. That's why I like N-O-W now, because in its center is nothing. And in the center of that zero is even more nothing. So, in the center is this beautiful silence. And if you're aware enough, you're just sitting here, just being kind, being mindful, you're in this moment, and you will notice there's no thoughts going on in your mind. You didn't say no to those thoughts, you didn't try to stop them. They just stopped. They're not necessary anymore. You've gone right into the middle of the present moment, into this beautiful silence. And already that second layer of petals is very beautiful and enormously fragrant. Just to be silent. All truth comes from silence. You don't get wisdom by thinking or by reading or by listening to monks like me. You become wise by developing your own silence. And in silence, that's what you see. The opposite of silence, when we have this commentary, you're not really seeing the world, you're just seeing the words. You're just noticing all the signposts of life, not where they're pointing to. But when all the words stop, then you may be able to understand what those words were pointing to all along. A little meditation exercise, in order for you to practice this, another little exercise, is actually understanding what words actually do, their effect. So I'm just going to do this little exercise with you now, and I want you to be mindful of the reaction you have inside your mind after I say these words.
Anger.
Do you see, the word was just a signpost, but I pointed you in that direction. You resisted a lot because no one likes anger, but you can see, you can start to feel the anger. You start to know it because the word was pointing to something. What anger actually means is an experience. And now you can try something else. Peace. Peace. Once the word stops, the mind looks in that direction too. So you actually see where that signpost is pointing to. You understand what peace is, not its signpost, not its label, but what it actually is. That's why all the words, they've got a meaning, they've got a function. They are there to point to what those words represent. And once you've got what they represent, you don't need the words anymore. They've done their job. You're in peace. You don't need to have any more signposts. You've arrived. So, soon we get to that stage. We're right in this moment and we're silent and we don't need any more signposts, no more labels. Now we're in the silence, so close to the truth and reality. So what happens next? Again, because the way that you have been brainwashed, and I'm trying to re-brainwash you, is we always in life go from one thing to another. It's a sequence of achievements. We go to grade one and then grade two. If we graduate, then grade three. And then we go on to this certificate and the next certificate. We're always going on this journey, stage by stage, lap by lap, journey by journey. You see the kilometer signs on the roadside, 1 kilometer, 2 kilometers. We always measure ourselves by progress. And so that's so embedded into our psyche. But even in meditation, we try and do the same sort of thing, and it never works. This is stage one, this is stage two, this is stage three, this is stage four. Where are you so far? Only on stage two. Oh, I feel so bad, I'm only on stage two. That is very worldly stuff. Nothing to do with meditation or spiritual paths. So, no stages. Instead, we always go in. We stay where we are. We're not going anywhere. That's the world. Going places. This is just being here. Being as fully as you possibly can where you already are. So you go into this moment, you go into the silence. You don't do anything. You don't go anywhere. If you're trying to get somewhere, yeah, you have to do something. But if you want to be here, you've got to stop all this doing and stay. Just have mindfulness and kindness to the silence. And once you have enough mindfulness and kindness to the silence opens up. The next layer of petals is revealed. And surprise, surprise, that next layer of petals, if you don't choose anything, is your breathing. The breath meditation is not something the Buddha designed. It's something which was already there. It's just the nature of letting go to have these stages occur. And the reason why is when you're sitting still, you're not seeing anything. Actually, when you first meditate, you do see something. You close your eyes, I see the back of my eyelids. But because nothing is happening, because it's dark on the back of my eyelids, it's the nature of the brain, if nothing happens, to turn off. Very similar to the screensavers on your computer. If you don't click the mouse, it turns off. That's what sight does. It stops. If there's no change in the level of the sound, there's always some ambient sound, constant sound, but if there's no great change, then the ears turn off. There's nothing to hear. Therefore, it actually switches off. Now, when sound or hearing turns off, you don't suddenly know, oh, now it's turned off. No more than you can catch that moment when you close your eyes when the sight turns off. It's a natural process which happens. You realize, oh, I wasn't seeing anything. Oh, I wasn't hearing anything. So the hearing turns off because there's nothing to attend to, nothing to interest the brain. The smell and the taste, that's why we don't chew sweets or anything during the meditation, because that would interfere with our taste. It's also why we try and make sure that people don't let off wind during the meditation, because that will change the smell. So as long as people don't do anything disgusting, then the smell remains the same. That's also one of the reasons, I should have told you this when I was talking about all of the traditions, the rites and rituals in Buddhism, that's one of the reasons why people used to light incense. Because people didn't have deodorant in those days. So you can see the countries which use the most incense, they must have the most smelly people. I don't think I should go much further in that direction. But anyway, the whole point is to have a constant smell which doesn't change. So, you know, the olfactory, that's this thing over here, that turns off. So you know, you've got four of the five senses turned off. This body, you know, it's so hard to let go of this body. There's always an ache or a pain or an itch. I'm thirsty. I want to go to the toilet. I want to eat. I've got a cough. I've got a sneeze. I've got a scratch. This body is such a hard thing to turn off. So how do you do that? You sit very still. You get yourself comfortable, first of all. That's one of the reasons why posture, any posture where you can be reasonably comfortable. And there is no magic posture. I know that some traditions say you've got to put your hands in a certain way, you've got to have your back straight, you've got to have your head down, you've got to have... Oh, come on, that's not true. I've had some incredible deep meditations in the most weird postures. The standard was, I had scrub typhus in Thailand about 35 years ago, a very, very bad fever. It's the same as typhoid, you can't really tell the difference. And so I had a terrible fever for about 3 or 4 weeks. No one knew what was going on. I felt awful, really weak, you know, really pain. And everything was just really, really awful. And one day I decided, come on, you're a monk, meditate. So in the middle of a fever, I meditated. And it was amazing. You can do that. You can go meditate, go right inside yourself and get into really lovely bliss states. Because you know what to do. You don't fight. You just let be. And you get right inside yourself, and where there's no pain at all, having a wonderful time. But when I came out afterwards, it was a very deep meditation. The thing which I noticed when I emerged, I was on the hospital bed, and I looked at my posture. And I've never seen a posture like that in any meditation book. There's one leg this way, one leg that way, and I'm over here, and I'm over there. It was all over the place. But I just got into a really nice meditation. That taught me that the body, as long as the body is comfortable, however it wants to be comfortable, that's up to it. You can get into the most deepest of meditations. So, as long as your body's comfortable. But you know, you can't make it totally comfortable, this body. You know, you try even the best, most comfortable chairs, you always have to fidget or scratch or do something. So you do the best you possibly can at the beginning. You get your body reasonably comfortable. And then, you're just in this present moment, in the silence. And it's pretty comfortable, it's not moving. Because it doesn't move, it tends to disappear. Because it's nothing's happening, it vanishes. Until the only thing which is moving in the body is your breathing. Because it's the last thing which is moving, breathing in, breathing out. When everything else disappears, that's what's left. That's why that next layer of petals is the breathing. It is the natural course of things. And when I meditate, you know, these days I never decide to watch the breath. I just, you know, really be kind, be in this moment, be mindful, and you just go into this present moment. You just go into the silence, and you just go into the breath. It's just like the lotus opening, it comes to you. You've got this breath. If you start to look for the breath and decide to invite the breath in, you will notice whenever you start watching the breath because you decide to, the breath is never comfortable. It's always a bit hard to watch at first. But if you wait until it comes to you, it's always very peaceful and very easy to watch. That's why I prefer that method these days. So just the lotus is opening. Now I'm on this breath. And that's the lotus petal. Again, that breath is in the silence. It's right in the middle of the present moment. You're just going deeper into where you already were when you began. And right in the middle you see this breath. And of course, you are caring for this, mindful of it. You don't do anything. You're just with this breath. And what happens next? The next layer of petals which opens up, one, as long as you're mindful and kind. If you're not kind to this breath, then it runs away. You can't maintain it. If you're kind to it, it stays. The simile is this. I smile at you and you smile back. That's nature, isn't it? You smile at the breath and the breath smiles back. You're kind to it, and it becomes a much more delightful object to watch. You scowl at it, And the breath doesn't look very nice. You can't keep your attention on it so well. You have to have this beautiful softness and kindness in meditation. If you have that softness and kindness, when you watch the breath, it's a delightful thing to watch. It's your attitude which makes it delightful. So you're watching this breath, and with kindness and with mindfulness, and the next layer of petals which opens out is what we call, I mentioned this in brief earlier, the full awareness of the breath. You're watching the breath from the very beginning of an in-breath to the end of an in-breath. From the beginning of the out-breath to the end of the out-breath. You don't just choose to do this. I'm sure many of you have tried to do that. Okay, let's watch from the very beginning to the very end. Yeah, you can do that through will, but you can't really sustain that very long. But if it happens naturally, because your mindfulness is increasing, you're just being kind, you can see this breath from the beginning to the end of just one in-breath. And every sensation is different. Every breath is unique. There's never been a breath like that ever before. And even this part of the breath has never begun that way ever before. Something you thought was very boring becomes incredibly interesting. It grabs your mind. This is the beautiful layer of petals called the full awareness of the breath. The deeper you go into the lotus, the more beautiful are the petals, the more fragrant and the more delicate, just like the layers in your mind. Beautiful breath. So this delicious, beautiful, full awareness of the breath, from the beginning to the end. And all you're doing is just caring for it, being mindful. Again, if the idea comes up, what should I do next? Then your lotus is going to close up. You've lost the present moment. You're not caring anymore. You've just lost it. So be very careful. Don't ever think, what should I do next? It's all being here. What am I doing now? Be more fully aware of the full awareness of the breath. It's going in, going out. And the next thing which opens up, I jumped ahead of myself a bit, was when it becomes incredibly delightful. It's a delightful breath, from the awareness of the breath, the full awareness of the breath, to the delightful breath. It's a natural thing which happens. It's just like the opening of a lotus. The petals in the middle get more and more attractive. So the breath becomes incredibly attractive. You're just watching this breath come in, watching the breath go out, with a lot of joy. So there's no longer any having to do something. You're really having fun. A lot of fun. It's satisfying. It's joyful. Now, many times when this happens in meditation, people think, oh no, I'm going to get attached to this. Exactly, you're supposed to get attached to this. I said recently, when people say, are you sometimes attached? Oh yes, I'm very attached. When I get on an aircraft, I'm very attached to the seat. I'll put the seatbelt on. Otherwise, I'll fall off. If you go on a motorbike, please be attached to the motorbike until it stops. Otherwise, you'll fall off. Attachment is good sometimes. Otherwise, you fall off everything. So, when you're enjoying this delightful breath, attached to that. That's an important part of the journey. A Buddha once gave this incredibly profound simile of the raft. He said, yes, if you are crossing from one bank to the other, you have to get on a raft. But once you get onto the other side, then you can let go of the raft. Don't be attached to it then. But please don't give up the raft in the middle of the river. Don't jump off until you get to the other side. So attachments are fine. They've got a purpose for them. It's only we keep them too long, that's the trouble. So, you attach the joy. Get off on it. Have fun. You know, as a monk, it was so wonderful, such a great revelation, to realize there was something I could enjoy. Without any guilt at all. You gave up sex, you gave up movies, you gave up music, that was a tough one. No, food, you know, you can't really give up food. But, you know, in northeast Thailand it was disgusting anyway, so there's not much joy in eating boiled frogs. But the one thing which I could enjoy was my meditation. And I thought, well, isn't it wonderful? The Buddha said, okay, you can do that. You can enjoy your meditation. Isn't that wonderful? And that's actually the heart of my monastic life, enjoying my meditation. You can take everything else away. You can beat me, you can kick me, you can scold me. The meditation keeps you going. Beautiful, joyful meditation. So, you have this beautiful meditation. That's an inner layer of the lotus. And I call that one of the most important stages in the meditation. The tipping point, the fulcrum. Because once you get to that, then you're off and running. Then just the meditation is no problem anymore. Then you're going to get some incredible, wonderful and powerful stage. And all I've got to do is to stop you interfering with the process. So you can just off you go, all the way into jhanas, enlightenment, the whole works. Because you're getting joy up in the meditation. The breath is really nice and beautiful. Because it's beautiful, there's no effort at all required to watch. The mindfulness becomes absolutely natural, automatic, you know, unavoidable. You just have to be mindful. It's just wonderful. And with that mindfulness and that warmth, that beautiful, delightful breath gets so soft, so even, so nice, so smooth. There's hardly any difference between the in and the out breath. In fact, there is no in breath or out breath. It's just this moment of breath happening now. It's only the past or the future by which you can know that was an in breath and out breath. But when there's no more time left, there's just this moment of breath, the same as all other moments of breath. So even that nothing is changing, but it disappears. It turns off. Now you go into a deeper layer of petals. Because when the breath disappears and vanishes through this method, it means that the last part of your five senses has now turned off. Sight has turned off, sound gone, smell, taste, and now your physical sensation of touch has now turned off. That's why the breath is important. It's like a stepping stone for you to let go of your body. So the body has totally vanished. And now at last you can be with your sixth sense, the mind. The citta, the most important part of this thing you call yourself. That's one of the reasons why we meditate this way. It's not just stillness for the sake of bliss, although bliss is there. It's to actually to understand, to have the insight into what this mind truly is. And how can you know what this mind is when it's all covered up with all these other senses? So once this mind is separated from the body and its five senses, at this stage in the meditation, you've got an idea, an experience of what this mind is, this sixth sense. So you're going into a deep layer now. All you have, the body has totally disappeared, and you're just starting getting close to the mind. And how do you experience these stages? These are the amazing stages of meditation. They're amazing because so few of you have experienced these before. Because they're terra incognito, means like unexplored territory, places you've never been before. It's so difficult to make sense of them. All the landmarks, all of the criteria by which you recognize this world does not apply to the world of the mind. It is very different. So much that sometimes you have to get up a new language, invent a new language, to describe this amazing world, the mental world. This is not imaginary, this is not fantasy, this is more real than anything else. Remember, by this time your mindfulness is incredibly strong. You're not dull, you're not dreaming, you're fully awake, much more awake than you've ever been before. You're there, the body's vanished, you can't see, you can't hear, smell, taste, physical touch, that's all gone. So what is left is this world of the mind. You know what it's like that if we didn't have all these lights on at night along the paths? If you were staying in a hut in a forest and in the night time you went outside, you wouldn't be able to see anything at first when you go outside, because the eyes are only accustomed to the bright light. So when you walk outside, you know, you can't see at first, but then the pupils of your eyes dilate, they get bigger to allow more light in, and then you can start to see silhouettes and then shapes and maybe even objects in the darkness. It takes about a minute or two for your eyes to accommodate to the dark, and then you can see. And that's very similar to what happens when the breath disappears. It takes a while before you can start to accommodate to the more subtle experience of consciousness without the five senses. Which is why for many people it's like a darkness first of all. Nothing's going on. If that happens to you, please don't interfere with the process. Just because, you know, there's nothing solid for you to look at. Don't think, what should I do? What should I do? Should I go back to the breath? Should I go to this? What should I do? In the meditation, if you can ask that question, you are conscious, you're aware of something. Even if it's a darkness, even if it's an emptiness, even if it's a blackness, that is the object of your awareness. Just be aware of that. Just for a while. Because usually what happens next, when the next layer of petals really opens up, then that is the world of the nimittas, these beautiful lights which appear in the mind. These are not lights, because the eyes are not working. The sense of sight has turned off. It is just, this is the language which we use, the nearest thing we can get to describe what's happening inside of our mind. That's how perception works. You know, the way we use our language, we see something or experience something, and that is similar to something else we've experienced somewhere else, and so we say that's what it is. You know, look at Dania, she's a woman because she's very similar to the other women I've known and seen. That's why you give her that name. You look at Venerable Dhammakamma, he's monk because he looks similar to all the other people. That's where we get our labels from, our names from. So when we get these nimittas, they're not lights, but that's the nearest thing, which is why we describe these things as lights in our mind. And they just flash up first of all. Sometimes when people first get their first experience of nimitta, they think, oh, this can't be a nimitta, the sun is shining in my eyes. There is a car with a headlight pointing in my direction. Someone's got their flashlight in my face. I don't know how many times that people have come to me in interviews and said that it can't be a nimitta. And then I tell them, look at these windows. They're really high up. The sun doesn't shine through them. If it does, you know, sometimes in the morning, sometimes it can shine through, but it's all just this type of glass which, you know, doesn't get a proper image. It spreads it out. There are no windows on this room. You can't have car headlights. We don't use the flashlights. It can't be. It was a nimitta. Well done. What's really interesting to me is why people just don't give themselves the benefit of the doubt. People are so negative, they think, oh, I can't get a nimitta, not me. It must be something else. And that hindrance of doubt, you know, really shows a lack of self-worth. Thinking, I can't do this. You can do it. You do it. Many people get nimittas. So a light appears in the mind. Well done. But don't get excited. Oh, nimitta, 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 nimitta. It's really a great shame because you worked so hard to get there. Now you're there, you just trip up on the doorstep going into jhanas. So just it's only nimitta, that's all. You know, it's just a beautiful light in the mind. Just leave it alone. It's just bliss, that's all. It's just ecstasy. It's just so just leave it alone and just be quiet. You just have to be mindful and just to care. And what usually happens, because people can't resist sort of being afraid or excited, it usually pops up and disappears again. Unfortunately, then you have to do it all over again until after a while, those stages I mentioned earlier of recognition, familiarity and ease, until you really do think, oh, it's just the old nimitta again. Just like it's somebody you know very, very well, very well. And when it's somebody you know very, very well, then there's no excitement anymore, nor fear. Just like a good old friend coming to visit you. I come in, have a cup of tea. And that's what you do with this nimitta, and it stays with you. So it's a beautiful light in the mind. And it's tough to recognize it at first. That's why you know some people say, you know, can you get into these jhanas without the nimittas? Yes, sort of, but the nimitta is there, you just got to learn how to perceive it. What you're experiencing, everyone experiences the same, exactly the same. What you experience it, you can perceive it this way or that way. Perceiving it as a light is much more useful for practical purposes. And it doesn't matter what colour it is. It does not matter what shape it is. What's really important with the nimitta is, number one, its stability. So it's not moving all over the place. It's resting. It's still. And the other thing which is important, it's power. It's really, really intense. This is just what happens. The lotus is opening up. It's going very deep inside that lotus now. It's incredibly beautiful in there. So this is the wonderful light. And in order to keep it stable, the insight which helped me enormously was realizing that that nimitta was nothing more than a reflection of my mind, the one who was watching. And if me, the one who was watching, was moving, then the nimitta would move. So the watcher, me, had to be perfectly still. If the watcher was still, the light was still. So you're observing yourself. This is your mind reflected like in a mirror. And if you, the watcher, the observer, moves, the nimitta moves. So this is another exercise in stillness, perfect stillness. The more still you are, the more still the nimitta. And the other thing which happens is it gets incredibly powerful and brilliant. Even in the last retreat, somebody mentioned that they got a nimitta and it got so bright they thought they were going to go blind. And I laughed because I remember that happening to me. And remember, this is not being seen with your eye. It's a mental object. You never go blind. In fact, you just get more and more blissed out. The intensity can get as much as it likes. Just a sign of incredible energy which is building up inside. And with that brilliant energy, there's also a lot of ecstasy as well. This is going to be the happiest times of your life. Enjoy it. And when I mention this, I've always got to be very careful, because as soon as I start to say this is ecstasy, the most brilliant time of your life, craving, 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 craving comes up. I want to. But if you have craving, it doesn't happen. You lose the present moment. It just happens. You have a wonderful time. Really, really blissed out. And that nimitta gets very, very, very strong. When it gets very, very strong, it gets to a certain point. You go into the next layer of petals. And in that next layer of petals, the experience, the common experience is, if you're aware of the transition, you feel yourself falling into that nimitta. Or the nimitta coming to surround you, you go into its center. All of these progresses, if you like, are not progresses, they're ingresses. You're going deeper into where you were before. Deeper into the center of that nimitta. And right into the center there, you get this incredible bliss, which is very, very stable. And those are the blisses of the jhanas. In those jhanas, you are totally removed from the five sense world. That's why even in the Pali, they describe them as vivicheva kamehi, separated from the five senses. So there, it's amazing. You're free of seeing things, hearing things, blah, 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 blah. Free from having to feel this body, which is really, really heavy. And it's a great sense of liberation, which is why it's called a liberation by the Buddha, a temporary liberation. You're in the world of the mind, in the jhana realms. And that's what this meditation is going to lead you to. Number one, It's incredibly enjoyable. Really, no, really, really enjoyable. And number two, very profound. So when you come out of these afterwards, number one, you're going to be sort of a bit of a different character. It's going to give you a totally different understanding of this world and what's possible. And also that these are the places you get incredibly powerful insights. Because you're seeing a totally different reality you ever expected could exist. And I'll explain what those insights are afterwards. But in the first place, I just want you to experience some of those. Because that's what this meditation does. And all it is an opening up of the lotus. As you go deeper into the jhanas, it's just this first layer of jhana petals opens out, and right in the center is the second jhana. Those petals open out, in the middle of the second jhana is the third jhana, in the middle of the third, the fourth. In the middle of the fourth jhana, you go into another incredible realm of jhanas, which is called the arupa immaterial realms. 1, 2, 3, 4. And that is hardly any petals left at all. There's just vanishing. And then right in the middle, the last layer of petals, right in the very middle of the lotus, which is you, is called the jewel in the heart of the lotus. The Padme Mani. The Mani is the jewel in the heart of the lotus. And you know what that is? The jewel in the heart of the lotus. Right in the center of you. In the middle of the jhanas, you've gone right into the very, very center of this thing you call yourself, your body and mind. You know what's there? Should I tell you? What is that jewel? Nothing. It's empty. Nothing there. That is the jewel in the heart of the lotus. Om Mani Padme Kong. It's a con. Nothing in there. It's a dud. No one's in there. I thought there was somebody in here. I go to the right centre, there's no one left. It's totally empty. No self, anatta, sunyata. Nothing there. So that's the jewel in the heart of the lotus. And actually that's the most precious jewel of all. Nothingness and emptiness. Everything else is so materialistic. Nothingness, emptiness. It is the emptiness, the space, which embraces us all. What's between you and the person sitting next to you? Emptiness. That's what connects us. That's what surrounds us. That's the beauty of life. Emptiness. But we keep on putting things in. That's why even in this room, if you notice that there's hardly any furnishings in this room, nothing on the walls, no pictures, no photos. We did have, when I first built this place, somebody got these four big flower pots and put them in the corner. I was really disappointed, so I chucked them out. I think they're outside. Why is it? Can't we have a nice corner which is empty? Why do you want to put a flower pot in there for? It's beautiful because it's empty. Why do you want to sort of paint the walls? It's beautiful. They're empty bricks. So the whole purpose of this room is to remind you, there's nothing here. So don't try and destroy nothing. Nothing is sacred. Nothing is better than anything. So that's what happens, the simile of the jewel in the heart of the lotus. The most important part of that is how it happens. The technique, the method, if you like, which is being kind, being mindful. And that's it, nothing more. And all these things happen. The lotus happens all by itself. Just be patient. Wait in this moment. Don't wait in the future. And then it all happens quite naturally. It's an amazing thing to watch. The only time it doesn't work is when you interfere. You don't follow instructions. Follow instructions, it all opens up naturally, beautifully. Wonderfully, and you'll start to understand, wow, even me, of course you, every lotus has got the beautiful petals inside. You just need to open it up. You have amazing meditations. And that makes me a happy monk, when you have these great meditations and you come to me. I always like this, because people come up and it's the nearest simile which I can get is when, you know, you may have a son or a daughter and they've just fallen in love. Daddy, daddy. I met this amazing boy. Oh, I'm in love. That's what it's like when you get these deep meditations for the first time. Oh, I don't know. It's really sweet. So anyway, I hope that happens to you. So any questions? Questions or comments about the talk on jhanas and opening up the lotus? Yeah. Just one moment, just now. How long does it take? No time. It takes no time at all. No. Immediately or an hour, that's time. I say it takes no time at all. You have to let go of time and then it can happen. If you start to see half an hour, 2 hours, 2 days, 7 days, that's time. So no time at all means you have to let go of all your perceptions of time. To hell with time. It's just cracking your years and days and weeks. That's such a pain in the neck. So just sit down and just be. And then it's no time. Yeah? They can change shape because you're moving. They change.
So it's a matter of you being out of the space still and not
yeah. Excited. Yeah, that's right. The nimitta light gives you feedback. So if the nimitta's moving, you're moving. So somehow you've got to be still. The nimitta moves over here, moves over there, change shape, then you're changing shape. So calm down, be more still. And you know that you've got your still when your nimitta is still. It gives you that feedback, which is why it's a brilliant state of meditation. And that's why I say when you perceive those nimittas as lights, it's very helpful because you can get very clear feedback whether you need to have more energy, you know, just stay for a bit longer, build up the energy because it gets brighter and brighter, or you need to sort of keep it very still. It gives you the feedback, which is very important. Hard to find the balance not to try to be mindful. That's why that's the trick of meditation. You can't find that balance. You need sort of teachers like me, other people, to keep brainwashing you, to keep reconditioning you, to, until you sort of decide, oh, just I'm going to give up. You know, there's a lot of times that's when people get their best meditations. They get so frustrated, they've been here for 8 days, and they're leaving tomorrow. Oh, gee, I'm giving us up. This is hopeless. Just sit down. When you're not trying, that's when it happens. There's so many cases, like this one girl, I was like talking about her experience. We're doing this retreat at Khao Lak in Thailand for the Buddhist Fellowship. And she was very diligent, hour after hour meditating and getting absolutely nowhere. And then sort of the retreat finished. And then there was about an hour before she was going to get her bus back to the airport. And so she told me, she had an hour, nothing to do. She decided to kill time. Just kill time meditating. And after the hour, she came to see me. And she was just, I was having my lunch, and she was on the ground. Oh, I jumped up. That was wonderful. I can't repeat it, but it was something like that. So because she wasn't trying for the first time, she really let go. Then it happened. Like I was going to tell you this story later on, but it comes up now. This is Ajahn Chah's simile, one of the best similes he's ever given. And this was the very first year in Thailand when I was with him in 1974. Yeah, about 74, 75. And he said his monastery was a mango orchard. This is the mango orchard simile. His monastery was a mango orchard. There's no mangoes in that monastery then. I thought, what's he talking about? And he said, those mangoes were planted by the Buddha. Nevertheless, oh, it's one of his similes. And he said, those mango trees now are mature and every branch and twig is dripping with ripe, juicy mangoes. They're there. And he said, you monks these days, you meditators these days, you nuns these days, You're so lucky. You don't have to throw a stick up to get the mango to fall. You don't need to shake the tree. You don't need to climb the tree to get a mango. Because of the great wisdom of the Buddha, all you need to do is to sit under the mango tree, put out your hand, and a mango will fall in. And that was the story. And I thought, that's absolutely ridiculous, that's stupid. I've been to mango orchards. You know, if I sat under a tree and put my hand out like this, I'd be out there for hours. If a mango fell, knowing my luck, it would fall on my head. Never in my hand. That's not how you get a mango, but obviously you realize it's a simile. That's how you get jhanas, enlightenment, the paths and fruits. If you shake the tree, you climb the tree, or throw sticks up, nothing falls. That's called effort. Open your mind, open your heart with kindness and mindfulness, and all these things fall into your hand. And how beautifully true that is. I say that from experience. It's not your experience yet, so you have to trust. But you try that. Open up your heart, your mind, and do absolutely nothing. And then the mangoes fall. You do something, you shake the tree, and those mangoes cling on for dear life. They never fall. It's such a brilliant simile from Ajahn Chah, one of his very best. It's so hard to sit there with the hand open. Okay, so you don't throw the sticks up. You tell your friend, you throw the stick up. I'm going to put my hand out. You always try and get around this sort of doing nothing business. It is hard to do, but that is an incredible way. So anyway, so eventually you do it. Sometimes out of frustration. Meditating year after year after year after, you get nowhere. And until the end, okay, I'll give it a try. And you find it works.